Good morning. Welcome to the House Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee for Thursday, March 15th. The clerk will take the roll call.
Representative Szymanski.
Present.
Representative Mazerall.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Allen. Representative Anderson. Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish. Representative Grunhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom. Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane. Representative Lesch. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Schumacher. Representative Smith. Representative Swazinski. Representative Vogel.
Here.
Representative Wardlow.
Here.
Okay. The quorum is present. Do we have anyone that would like to move the minutes of the previous meeting? Representative Vogel moves the minutes of the previous meeting. Any discussion to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Good morning, Representative Kiffmeyer. Our first bill on the agenda for today is House File 2188 by Representative Kiffmeyer. Welcome to our committee. Please begin with, first we need to move the bill. Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill.
Where are we going? All right.
To Ways and Means, please.
Yes. House File 28 is moved to proceed, move, recommended to pass, and to be sent to Ways and Means. All right. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very pleased today to bring you House File 2188 to your committee. It's a very important subject, something that is very important for us because people who are under guardianship are in a vulnerable situation. So it is very important for us to act on their behalf, both to protect their rights and also to take care of them if they are unable to and they need help to be able to function in our world today. I do, Mr. Chairman, before I get into my presentation, I do have a DE3 amendment. And if it would be possible to put this bill in that shape at this time, it would be better to testify to that bill, to that language.
Mr. Chair, I move the DE3 amendment be adopted.
All right. Is there any discussion to the motion, to the DE3 amendment? Or all those in favor of the DE3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. We will now be working from the DE3 amendment. Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I want to give a special thanks to the Disability Law Center, to the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities, to Bob McLeod, a member of the Bar Association, subject matter expert, to County Attorney Don Ryan, and many others, and the parents and family members who have been very helpful in working on this project. This is a very important issue, as I've stated before, and Mr. Chairman and members, just to quickly go through the guardianship bill as it is before you right now today. The first section in the DE3 amendment has to do with the line 1.8, where we clarify under a guardianship, and as you will see in the rest of the bill, that in the Constitution it says people who are under guardianship are not eligible to vote nor shall be permitted to vote. And so stemming from that and, again, working with all these other entities that have been very helpful, this is the language we came up to implement that. So 1.8, just simply under a guardianship. And also the courts in Section 2 have requested that they would be able to have the data needed for jury selection, and so that language is here at the request of the courts. Section 3 follows through again with a similar language as in Section 1 as to guardianships. Section 4, again, follows through with the permanent registration, maintains residence at the end as shown, and in line 2.11 is not under a guardianship. Section 5 is a definition, and this is agreed-to language by the member of the Bar Association Disability Law Center that in the last committee hearing they felt we had discussed originally a definition, was it needed or not, and together we said no, we didn't think it was needed. However, since then, upon closer look, we all agreed that a definition, and I think that we have come with a very short, simple definition, which is if you're under guardianship, it means that a ward is under a court order that restricts the right to vote due to the ward lacking sufficient understanding or capacity to vote. And under Section 6, limited guardianship means that a ward is under a court order that restricts some rights due to a ward lacking sufficient understanding or capacity but does not restrict the right to vote. Many conversations, and by the way, members, in the Guardianship Act itself, the concept of guardianship and limited guardianship is already in that area of law. This is just building on that, adding a definition in regards to the voting right in particular. Section 7, again, a Bill of Rights for Wards and Protected Persons. If you note on line 3.34, to vote unless restricted by the court. And then it is replaced on line 4.4, the next page, pursuant to the Minnesota Constitution, Article 7, an individual placed under a guardianship shall not be entitled or permitted to vote in any election in this state. That is consistent language there with that distinction. On the findings, order of appointment, on line 4.21, one of the areas that in talking with the county attorney and the Bar Association, others as well, is the lack of clarity and specificity in regards to guardianship in statute, realizing that when you have guardianship, you have the ward, you have the guardian, you have the court, and many times as well, you have the care providers. And those four should all be clear as to the status as they are clear with any other right in regards to guardianship. And so on line 4.21, in making an order, the court shall explicitly declare whether the order establishes a guardianship or a limited guardianship and the effect of the order on the ward's right to vote. I thought what was interesting is that in discussing this with some folks who are currently under guardianship but are mentally competent, they have a good capacity to vote. They're very smart people. And for them to be able to say, as a reason of dignity, to be able to say, I'm under limited guardianship. And the implications that go with it are very valuable to them. And in discussions with the Disability Law Center, they felt that that was a very valuable preservation of their dignity in being able to say, I needed some help, but I didn't need the full guardianship. Again, going through to the next pages, on page 5, on section 8, line 4.12, again, being clear with the communication between the court, the guardian, and the ward, and the possible care providers. So within 14 days after an appointment, a guardian shall send by certified mail a copy of the order to the ward's current residential address, addressed to the ward, and if applicable, to the administrator or other responsible person. And if the address changed, continue to do the same, but they do not apply if the guardian resides at the same address as the ward. Again, clear communication amongst all four is very important. Section 9 is rather long, but the only change that occurs in Section 9 is on page 8, line 5, again restating the language of before pursuant to the Minnesota Constitution. In Section 10, there's the annual report of a guardian, and it includes, as it has, many of the other necessary components of somebody who might be under guardianship to take care of their needs. On line 8.21 and 8.22, the guardian is able to have a voice as they are in everything else, whether in the view of the guardian the ward's eligibility to vote should be restored or continue unchanged. And the focus is here not that the guardian makes any final determination, but that the guardian is able to have a voice and have a responsibility and duty in this area. On subdivision 2, 9.8, we also have a continuation of communication and the well-being report. And 9.20, again, the limited guardian or the guardian needs to be sure that they communicate to the ward and anybody who is also responsible, such as an administrator or other responsible person, if it be in a facility, but not if they live at the same address. Section 11 goes into the duties of facilities. Again, clear communication. Overseeing, they must maintain the documents submitted to them by a guardian. They maintain a written list of wards who reside at their facility and the current voting status. They ensure that staff directly assisting wards in the voting process only assist those who are eligible to vote. and then a definition of residential facility. And then there is also an effective date of June 1st, 2012, but it may be compiled on an ongoing basis as documentation is received from guardians as required by law. Section 12 is a notice of voting eligibility status for current guardians, and it just requires that whatever status they have as of August 1st, that there be a letter sent out to the guardians. And that Section 13, the election materials, use of existing supply, that they may use current voter registration materials. They are consistent with this, with the spirit of this law, and that they can use up their existing supply, and that is very important for us to be able to do that. And then there is a $13,600 appropriation to the Secretary of State for costs associated, as well as that we have not received yet a fiscal note from the court as to their costs. And when we get to Ways and Means, by that time I would hope to hear from the court as well on what they may need here, if anything. And Mr. Chairman, that is a walk through the House File 2188, the DE3, as presented to you, Mr. Sure. Chairman. I also have a testifier.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. For the members of the committee, we do have an extensive agenda today. Does anyone object if we hold questions until after the testifiers have completed? Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer, please bring your testifier up.
Mr. Ron Kaus.
Good morning, Mr. Kaus. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you for having me this morning. My name is Ron Kaus. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota, just recently moved there. I had lived 25 years previous to that in Crow Wing County, and from the beginning of this ordeal, I've kind of been talking with Representative Kiffmeyer, so I really appreciate all her work. The way I got involved in this was the Saturday before the election, Monty Jensen called me up at home on the Saturday and said that he had tried to call the county attorney and was unsuccessful. And I also work with the Minnesota Freedom Council. It's a volunteer, nonpartisan organization. And we had been working on voter integrity issues and the military vote, that sort of thing. So he had called me because somebody had referenced him. And he said that he had witnessed at the Crow Wing County Courthouse disabled people, mentally incapacitated people being used for political purposes. They were told how to vote, he said, and then one person, as they went back to the voting booth, the voting assistant pulled the ballot out of their hand, put it on the whatever pedestal, and the vulnerable adult kept going out of the voting booth. And when the person tried to get them to return to the voting booth, they were unsuccessful, so the assistant then took the ballot, filled it out, went and got the person, then turned it in. And that's what set off this whole chain of events, that Monty Jensen is a disabled war vet, and he knew that something was clearly wrong here and that that had to be illegal. And so he challenged it at the desk of the county auditor, and they said that disabled people had a right to vote and that sort of thing, so nothing was done from that standpoint. But it set off a research project that me and some other people did because we wanted to get to the bottom of it. And what happened was is I got the Crow Wing County voter list and then matched it against the adult foster care facilities in the area. I found 22 hits with one particular foster care provider. Out of that, I took the results and then matched them against the judiciary website, and I found 16 of them were under some form of guardianship. Out of that, 7 were said to be mentally incapacitated, and out of that, 1 I personally knew and was a friend of mine for 20 years, James Steen. I called James Steen's parents, who are friends of mine, his guardians, and reported this to them, and they were just infuriated and just felt this deep sense of betrayal because they knew that James was incompetent. James is also a personal hero of mine that when he was 12, he dove into a river to save his sister from drowning and drowned, essentially. He was underwater for 20 minutes and suffered a traumatic brain injury. And so I don't know too many people who had given their life for someone, but I've always held him in high regard and watched out for him at church functions and other things. So anyone who knows James Steen knows that he cannot vote. And so Al Steen came and filed a complaint, and there was also a news team that did an interview with him, and which he said that he had no clue who the candidates were. He thought George Bush was president, and he voted for Gerald Ford in the 2010 election. And you can see that if you want to just Google him, James Steen, voter fraud. It should be one of the first hits that come up. So he, Al Steen filed a complaint, and we did some more research. We went in, and then we took all of the people and went and got their guardianship records just to see what the status was. And 12 of them were pre-2003, according to the law, which meant that they were set up as unable and ineligible to vote. Four of them actually had, in those 2003 court orders, saying that they had their rights revoked by the judge. And we also got the timestamp of the of what Monty Jensen saw right in front of him, and sure enough, that's what he saw that day. Two of them were right in front of him who were ineligible to vote, along with James Steen. So this set off a chain of events. We ran into a number of things. We found that the statute itself, to me, is unconstitutional. Under the Constitution, it says that you cannot be under guardianship, insane, or incompetent, according to the Minnesota Constitution, and be eligible to vote. The 2003 statute then undoes that and says, oh, you can be under guardianship as long as a judge hasn't revoked your right. And so we saw a clear problem there, and when we asked the court administrator in Crow Wing County about it, she was in the office. They said there was only one person who could figure this out, and that was the actual court administrator herself. They said that it was so confusing. And what we found was that there was widespread non-compliance with the 2003 law. So those four people probably were never put on, you know, state voter registration saying that they were challenged or ineligible by the court administrator according to the 2003 law. So, and then it, the big thing is it opened them up for political exploitation, the vulnerable adults, this law did. It opened the door wide open to if somebody saw a way to use vulnerable adults politically, this is what happened. And what we found was it was a local election that seemed to be the motivation in this case. So after trying hard to protect his son, Al Steen ran into a number of roadblocks. The sheriff had a conflict of interest. The county attorney didn't want to prosecute. And the adult foster care provider retaliated against them. So he decided to pull his son out of Crow Wing County and take him back to Montana where he was living. And he took him back to Montana, and on the very next day he died. Al Steen died of a heart attack and I believe a heartbreak. And it was 1 year, exactly 1 year after his son was exploited. So I am speaking in favor of this bill because I believe it brings clarity to something that is very confusing. It brings compliance to the Constitution, Minnesota Constitution, and it builds a fence of protection for James Steen and other vulnerable adults.
Thank you, Mr. Coutts. Representative Kiffmeyer, any comments, or are we ready for questions from our committee?
Mr. Chairman, glad to have comments. Just to let you know, I am also a guardian for my sister, who has a mental age of about 3 or so. And so knowing of the guardianship process, but the initiating of this legislation had to do with the bill that I had last year and becoming aware of this lack of clarity. And so, however, when I heard of this story happening, being a guardian myself, and my sister lives in a care provider home, this is something that I have personal experience with and concern. It always is a concern of guardians when your ward that you're responsible for is living somewhere else. To be, you know, it's a very trusting situation in letting a personal family member be in that situation and looking out for them and looking over them. my sister and I are together guardians, so we do it together. But I think it is something that every parent or anybody who is a guardian has a fear and a concern that the ward may be exploited in some way. So it was certainly a concern of mine, and I think that this bill addressed that. But, Mr. Chairman, any other questions? I'd be glad to answer them at this time.
Before we get to questions, does anyone else in the audience wish to testify for or against this bill? Sir, please come forward. And again, because we are on a limited time schedule, if you can keep your comments as brief and succinct as possible, we would appreciate it.
I will. Thank you, Chair. My name is Ben Ashley Wortman. I'm the Policy and Outreach Associate at Mental Health Association of Minnesota. We're the state's oldest education and outreach organization for people with mental illnesses. I have testified on this bill previously, so I will confine my remarks to a few brief points in particular interest to this committee. I do want to thank Representative Kiffmeyer for her openness to feedback and listening carefully to our concerns. As I have indicated, we do support the affirmative notification that tells wards, guardians, and care providers about what orders are already in place as part of a guardianship. However, we retain deep concern about the other provisions of the bill. Minnesota's courts are strained. Chief Justice Gilday has spoken forcefully about this issue. Wait times are up and caseloads have increased. We struggle to find the balance between budget constraint and the need for justice. Guardianship is an anomaly in the court system with a less than fully adversarial process. All parties want the good of the ward, in theory, but with a hurried court and a bad guardian, much can be hidden in these pro forma annual reports. The ward need not be seen, and the guardian presents the bulk of the information. I will quote from an article from the Star Tribune, March of 2011. I'll note that they did an entire series on abusive guardians over the last couple of years. Terri-Ann Hogg's career as a lawyer came to an abrupt end in 1995 when state officials suspended her license for mishandling cases and lying to her clients. She, quote, went on to amass the state's fourth largest portfolio of work as guardians and conservators. Though Hogg never sought reinstatement as a lawyer, she and her company, Estate Resources, were given control over the lives and finances of more than 200 vulnerable adults, despite complaints of neglect. There are loving family members who are guardians, good agencies who provide these services, but there are also sharks, and the courts have not been given the resources, time, or law to stop them, despite the best efforts of this body in 2009 with the Bill of Rights for Persons Under Guardianship. This bill gives opportunity to further restrict the rights of wards. It erodes the strong presumption of rights by redefining guardianship from meaning least restrictive means in current statute to indicating highly restrictive. There are problems with guardianship in Minnesota, but we believe they lie primarily with a lack of uniformity in supervision, a deficit of attention to who can be a guardian, and for what reason. By creating an unnecessary subdivision, this bill would hamper further efforts to reform and improve guardianship. The problem of the abuse of a vulnerable adult at the polls can already be combated with current election laws. 2003 was an important step forward for the state. We recognized the growing awareness that people with disabilities often retain many abilities and should retain as many rights as possible. Our laws have come a long way from the days of the asylum and the institution. And if this evolution prevents a linguistic issue, I believe the greater issue is the outcome for the 23,000 Minnesotans who will be affected. This bill will place them in a highly restrictive status without court review, without regard for individual abilities. Courts would need to review that and undo it one by one if guardians report honestly, if they have time, and all before Election Day. We ask that you not give the courts an even more difficult task without additional resources. We ask that you not step back from the promise of the 2003 reforms and the 2009 Bill of Rights. We respectfully ask that this bill not proceed from committee. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we'll proceed to committee questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, under this bill, if a person who's under a guardianship votes, are they then to be prosecuted under the ineligible statute, and then would they become felons if found guilty?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, when you're in a situation like that, it is not the fault of the person who is complying with it. I mean, they are a ward. And so if something happens in that situation, it is the guardians and the caregivers who have the responsibility to make sure that they're not permitted to vote. So it would be more an issue for the guardians themselves or the care providers to make sure that there is that compliance. That's why that communication is built into this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if a care provider takes a ward to vote and they vote, if this becomes law, would they then be prosecuted under the statute and potentially be a felon?
Mr. Chairman and Representative
Kiffmeyer.
In regards to if you take anybody in regards to this, if somebody is, and again, in this case, there would be, if this bill is passed, the guardian would clearly have knowledge, or the care provider would clearly have knowledge that they are not eligible to vote, that that right to vote by the court has said that they don't have that right to vote. So if they take them against that court order, they are committing a illegal activity at that point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any private right of action for the vulnerable adult if they are taken to vote? If this becomes law and they're wrongfully taken to vote, can someone sue somebody to address that issue, a private right of action?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, if the ward were in a situation that they were taken against their will, I would believe that the vulnerable adult laws would apply in that situation, as it would to any other situation. If they were against their will or taken to do something that were not in compliance with a status that they have as a ward, remembering that this is guardianship is different, a distinction from a limited guardian. So a ward under a limited guardianship would be assumed to have capacity to vote, to be able to make those independent voting decisions, that would have more of a mental capacity. Someone such as my sister, who is very vulnerable, very compliant, she could be in many situations where that would be the case, but the person then who takes advantage of her or anybody in that situation would be the one who would be liable. And at that point, a ward usually under guardianship doesn't have the mental capacity to go to court and sue, but either somebody could make a complaint to the Department of Health that investigates any such complaints to first of all ascertain the facts of the issue, and then they would recommend actions to be taken from that. So usually in a ward who is under a full guardianship like this would be somebody maybe observing that, and that has happened. Many times somebody in this situation would be able to report that to the Department of Health and investigate that. But the first thing to do, Representative Hillstrom, is that I think we in the legislature, in the courts, and those who are caring about this should make sure that there is clear communication and clear understanding for the courts in regards to guardianship and this particular subject.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So, Representative Kiffmeyer, you stated that these folks under guardianship don't have the capacity to sue. So if the court makes a determination that they're not eligible to vote, and they believe that they should be, or someone who's helping care for them believes that maybe they should be, are they going to be entitled to a public defender to fight to get this constitutional right back? And if so, or if not, who's going to pay for the lawyer to make certain that these folks don't wrongfully have their right to vote terminated?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hillstrom, in the current guardianship process, the ward always has a voice in the process. Matter of fact, all guardians are required prior to first of all, when they first get established in a guardianship, or in this case might be a limited guardianship, it was the court that would have a say in that. There would be a hearing in that initial determination. In addition, every year on the anniversary of that guardianship, there is also a time, not only does the guardian have to send in the well-being report and comment on all variety of matters that are under guardianship, but also the guardian is responsible to give information to the ward, informing them and telling them that if they object to any part of this guardianship, here's the address, here's the court, here's what you do, and the guardian has to attest to the court that that information has been given to every single ward every year upon that well-being report. And in this legislation, it also allows for at any time during the year for the ward to petition the court for a change. And those are already expenses that are involved in the court process as part of the annual court hearing. And whenever myself, every 5 years in the guardianship process, there's also an opportunity for anybody from outside as well. So there are many protections for the ward and a voice for the ward at any time during the year and also in the annual well-being report to be able to have that information, that knowledge to petition the court. And there is no expense for the ward in regards to that process.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So whose expense is it for the lawyer to petition on behalf of this person or to appeal the status if their voting rights were taken and they believe that they were wrongly taken? Who's going to pay for that?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom, again, this is current statute, current law, current well-being report, current costs that are allocated by the legislature to the court system for this work.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the courts will be absorbing the cost because there will now be more reviews because there's going to be 23,000 potentially more people in the process. I think that's what I heard. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hillstrom and members, currently in the court system there's about 24,000 guardianships. Currently, the Secretary of State has a list of 36 people who are under guardianship who do not have the right to vote. Current law requires the court to give a list of those under guardianship who do not have the right to vote or that status to the Secretary of State office. Currently, the difference is between about 24,000 and Secretary of State currently has 36. And so that discrepancy between the two, and again, this is current law, and in regards to the wards petitioning the court, that is already funded. It is not a new requirement. It's already in the annual well-being report, and the process of doing that is already current law, and current ability to do that is already in statute. What we are adding to this process is clarification in regards to the status of voting rights, to just be explicitly clear to everybody involved.
Mr. Chair, just one final question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question to you. This is the Judiciary Committee, and we've heard testimony that the fiscal note isn't done yet from the court. Is it your intention to let this bill out of committee without seeing the potential cost to the court?
Mr. Chairman, Ways and Means is the Finance Committee, the next stop, and it is frequently done. We will take care of that funding question when you get to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it really clear. We do the judiciary policy funding issues in the Judiciary Policy Funding Committee. You don't typically pass them out without knowing at least that there's no fiscal cost or having a plan for how you're going to pay for it. And I strongly object if you plan to do that.
Representative Hillstrom, I'll take your comment under advisement. Next on our list is Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my comments were exactly the same as Representative Hillstrom here at the end anyway. That being, we're a Judiciary Finance Committee, and it looks like there's going to be extensive costs to the court administrator, and the judiciary, as we all know, is way underfunded, and this looks like another unfunded responsibility, and we really need to get some exact numbers before we move this kind of bill out of a finance committee. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, it is my intention to, and I've had conversations already with the court. My understanding is that they are just working on those numbers. I've talked with Ms. Marshall, and so it is my understanding that if you'd like to place a number in this bill at $25,000, I would be glad to do that.
Okay. Thank you for your comments, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, a couple questions. So that I'm very clear, it's my understanding as I read the current law is that a person can be put under a guardianship by the courts and still have in place the right to vote. And if what I think I heard you say, that there's approximately 24,000 people who have been, you know, given a guardianship or deemed to be under the guardianship of someone, and only 36 of those who are under this guardianship don't have the right to vote. Is that right? Did I hear that correctly?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion and members, there are more than 36, but the number that was communicated to the Secretary of State office by the courts was 36. Generally speaking, people who are in a guardianship situation, there is a greater number of them that probably are in a circumstance where they have a court order. As we know from the testifier, that we have folks who do have a court order in which they do not have the capacity and they are not able to vote, and that right to vote being taken away from them by the court, who are yet still voting. And so the question is, the difference between 36 and 24,000, that is a very large number. And so with certainty we can say it is probably more than 36, and we should have clarity in regards to that.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I think it's important that we start at the same place or space, because it appears that, just so I can get some clarity to your bill, because it appears like you are saying one thing, but then you're saying another. Like, for an example, here's what I think I've heard you say. And then this will lead to my next question. There are 24,000 folks who have a guardianship. But based on the information that has been supported or put forth by the Secretary of State's office, that there's only 36 people whose right to vote has been revoked. Although you believe that that 36 number is not the real number. And you use the word certainly. And I'm not quite sure that we can say that. But let me ask this question. So it's clear that we do have currently in process, excuse me, as a part of the judicial process, that if a person is deemed to be challenged in any shape, form, or fashion, they can come before the court, and the court is in a position to determine, based on testimony, based on information that's put before it, if someone's right to vote should be revoked. Is that right?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion, the current law and the current process is there and exists at this time. The issue is the 2003 Model Guardianship Act that has gone nationwide included in it a change of presumption. In the Minnesota Constitution, the presumption is if you're under guardianship, you're not eligible nor permitted to vote. In 2003, when the Guardianship Act was passed, that presumption in statute was reversed, contrary to the Constitution. There is there are many other changes done as well. But since 2003, there is that lack of clarity. But I think that we want to recognize that it appears as though there are some situations where probably the person's right to vote has rightly been taken away under lacking the capacity and yet are being taken to vote. That's a serious question. And so you're absolutely right that we do need that kind of clarity, but that bit of history is helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion.
Committee, I've sent around to you a document that I think is really important. And I think it's important for a number of reasons. One is because it outlines some important questions that have been put forward here by Representative Kiffmeyer, where there's already clarity. For an example, in Minnesota, only a court may decide whether an individual is competent to vote. And you see Minnesota Statute Section 524.5 there. No one may make this decision, including spouses, children, caregivers, doctors, or nurses, even if they are personally convinced that the individual is not competent to vote. There's a process in place. So individuals who are under guardianship, conservatorship, or for whom someone else has a power of attorney retains the right to vote unless it is specifically revoked by a court. That's the current law. There's clarity there. The second thing that you said that I believe is important for us to put before the committee. Voters are entitled to assistance to cast their ballots. I heard the previous testifier talk about, here it is, a person's at the polls, there's an election judge or someone who's helping that person. Well, let's get back to what you said. Clarity. Under Minnesota law, voters may receive assistance in marking their ballots by any person of their choosing, other than an agent of their employer, their union, or candidate. So me being a candidate, I couldn't go and help a person even if they chose to, because I would be an interested party. No person may assist more than three voters in marking their ballots. Alternatively, voters may choose to get assistance from two election judges of different major political partners. Hey, that's Minnesota Statute Section 204C .15. You also said, and I think it's clear because this legislation only confuses, it does not provide clarity, there's been clarity already provided, persons assisting voters may not in any way try to influence the voter's choice. Doing so is a felony. That's under current law. Minnesota Statute Section 204C .15. Also, you can also look at Minnesota Statute 204C .41. As such, if they were to do so, those organizing efforts to provide assistance to voters should consider providing safeguards, such as having two individuals provide assistance to voters together, to avoid any appearance of something being done wrong. There's clarity already provided. Lastly, I will say persons assisting voters must not mark the ballot if the voter cannot communicate his or her intention. For an example, you said clarity. Here's clarity under Minnesota Statute Section 204C again. It says, hey, it is not enough to know the voter's intent. If the voter cannot communicate their intention, then guess what? A person cannot mark the person's ballot. And the last thing that I'll say is that as I look at your legislation, what would be helpful for me is for you to help us understand the difference between a conservatorship and a limited, guardianship and a limited guardianship. Because right now, if there's 24,000 people that has that's under this auspices of a guardianship, then what are we supposed to do? Will the court now have to go back and require that those 24,000 people be notified, so that now that they can come in and a different determination can be made, in order to move some people who might be under the notion of a guardianship and move them to a limited guardianship if they might be competent enough to vote? What is supposed to happen under your present proposed legislation as it pertains specifically to that issue?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to the six questions or so. Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion, if current law were enough, then our testifier wouldn't be here. So yes, those are current laws. If current law were enough, the county attorney and Crow Wing in this particular situation who convened a grand jury found that under current law, he didn't have enough to prosecute. And the root of clarity is really important when we talk about things here, that in a guardianship right now, a guardianship, that word guardianship, you might have the right to vote or you might not. And yes, you come into court with all your rights. And it's only the court that is able to speak into that regard to a ward. And so right now, the one word guardianship is used for both. And as the Disability Law Center and Bob McLeod with the Bar Association recommended, and I have used their language here, is that if we have the definition of guardianship is for you do not retain the right to vote, and then that word guardianship is used in that case, and if you retain the right to vote, there may be other rights you retain, other rights not, and so their definition there is very clear. It lines up with the Constitution. If you don't have the right to vote, then guardianship is the definitional word that would be used. If you retain the right to vote, then you are under limited guardianship. Right now, it's just guardianship. And it's both under that one word, guardianship. And so with that definitional application, to help give clarity to that. That is Disability Law Center, and also the Mr. McLeod of the Bar Association. And by the way, the concept of doing this, when I was on a panel up in Brainerd and Crow Wing County, even the ACLU supported the concept of doing guardianship and limited guardianship because they felt that, that would be helpful, and again, for the dignity of the person under limited guardianship. Yes, if you are an eligible voter, you have those rights to get that kind of help. I mean, that's obviously current law, but the big question is if you're eligible. And if you're not, which in this case, people who were not eligible by court order were in a situation. So it doesn't matter if you have two political parties or anything else that you have, they weren't eligible to vote to begin with, and that should be clear. And it was the care providers that were there and involved in this situation that should have known. And so I think those are important considerations. I think I've addressed the questions that you mentioned to me, Mr. Representative Champion, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Champion.
Thank you so much. Well, Representative Kiffmeyer, with all due respect, you know, I understand you saying that from your perspective that current law is not enough. If it wasn't enough, we wouldn't be here. That there wouldn't be this issue with James Stein. That's your perspective. Well, I'm not so quite sure that is the way that I think about it, because we have a voter ID bill that's going on, and we've had no voter impersonations in the state of Minnesota. I'm not so sure that this bill provides any clarity. In fact, it does the very same thing that the voter ID bill has the undercurrent to do, which is to disenfranchise voters, because now what you're saying to us is that 24,000 people who may have some level of challenge will not be eligible to vote, because the only way that they would be eligible to vote, based on what you're saying, if this guardianship carries both those who have the capacity to vote and those who don't have the capacity to vote, and they both are under this labeling theory that's called guardianship, then what you're saying is that under your bill, 24,000 people will not be eligible to vote. But you have not indicated to us what the court is supposed to do in order now to get some clarity to the 24,000 people who now, just if this bill passes, just in its purest form. And if you're saying that you're using the Constitution that says that they can't vote because they have the label of guardianship, they can't vote. What is supposed to happen?
Mr. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion. Exactly. That is the question, and that is answered on Section 12. That the state court administrator shall provide to each guardian a notice restating the current voting eligibility status of any ward subject to the guardian supervision. And as was testified also earlier by Ben, and I'm sorry, I just forgot your last name, Ben. I just think of you as Ben, that his concern is he wanted the clarity in the letter to be both the status of you have the right to vote, or if you're in a situation that you do not have the right to vote. In listening to his testimony previously, in a previous, that he emphasized that it was very important that whatever the current status is, that the court send out a letter and say, this is your current status.
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Representative Champion.
Representative Kiffmeyer, if you're saying this is going to provide the clarity, then this is duplicative, because the court already provides clarity by court orders. They've already said when an individual's right to vote has been revoked, because that's a part of a court order. Therefore, a court order means that there was due process, which also means that there was proper notification, which means that that information goes to that individual or that person's caregiver. So this has already been done by court order. You testified that there's at least 36 people who've been notified that their right to vote has already been revoked. So now you're saying that now you want 24,000 people, for the court to notify 24,000 people and say what their rights are now that this, if this proposed legislation becomes law. So that means that there's a cost, and that gets to Representative Hillstrom's and Representative Johnson's issue, that we don't know of all the costs, not to mention the fact that this particular proposed legislation doesn't really provide us any clarity. In fact, it causes more confusion than it does clarity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, I think we've had sufficient comment in this regard that I can say at this time. I think it is, don't want to take up any more of your time restating what I already have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Lesh.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kiffmeyer, I wasn't totally clear about some aspects of the bill. I think those have been clarified since then by the discussion, which I guess is the point of discussion. But I'm wondering, is it your contention that these people, the 23,964, whose rights have not been already expressly curtailed for voting, that they're voting illegally already in light of Section 7 of the Article 7 of the Minnesota Constitution?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lesh and members. I think that since 2003, when the law was changed contrary to the Constitution, there are certainly people that are currently, that were previously under a conservatorship, and were under a different status in regards to the presumption of the right to vote being retained. But when the 2003 law was passed, contrary to the Minnesota Constitution, since then there have been numerous cases, the one that before you today, where there is this lack of clarity. I think there are many people that are under the current word guardianship that do retain the right to vote. And they should be eligible, they should retain the right to vote, and that should be clear.
Representative Lesh.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, if the 2003 law is, as you contend, unconstitutional, why haven't you challenged it in the courts?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, I think first the responsibility is of the legislature, that we should do our job as a legislature, first of all, before going to a court case.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. We did that job in 2003, Representative Kiffmeyer. We changed the law. And if you contend that that's wrong, I mean, I can't understand if it's clearly unconstitutional. It hasn't been challenged by the courts. Are you just suggesting that we redo the job or do the job differently?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh, I am here to, I'm not an attorney. I'm here as a legislator, and I know you're an attorney. Several folks are attorneys. And so maybe the court is a frequent place to just go to. But in general, when a regular citizen or a legislator would first go to the legislative process appeal to the legislature, to bring language to the legislature, to first do that as a matter of recourse, to not just jump to the courts and fill them more with something that the courts have a workload in front of them. You know, it's my opinion that first I will go to the legislature and to work on this to have an effect with this law and the Constitution first through the legislature.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
Representative
Kiffmeyer, I apologize. I was not trying to trip you up. That's not my intent here at all, to sneak something in. But as a lawyer, that is definitely what I think. When there's a statement that this law is unconstitutional, it's the job of the courts and the three co-equal branches to make that decision, which is why I asked the question. And I didn't know if there had been a court case. Maybe there had, but I just didn't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to reply. I did not say that this law was unconstitutional. What I said is that it doesn't line up with the Constitution. The Constitution says what it says, and my bill lines up the statute with the Constitution. I'm well aware that only the court has the power in regards to certain things like that, but in my opinion as a legislator, I am working to line up the statute with the Constitution in a way that preserves a maximum level of rights for any citizen of the state of Minnesota.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that in light of that, and in light of what Representative Champion brought up about the laws, is it your contention that the situation in Crow Wing County with Mr. Stein, was that illegal under the laws we currently have, or was that a legal action that you're attempting to modify through this law change?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, what I'm attempting to do here is add clarity to what in a specific situation by word of the Crow Wing County Attorney saying I can't prosecute because of a lack of certainty and clarity that the care provider said, well, I didn't know. And so I think we're just providing clarity and communication amongst all parties in regards to guardianship. You have the all interested parties, starting with the court, being explicit, being clear, and making sure that everybody that needs to know is in a situation that they do have that knowledge. And then going forward in the future, I would expect that that would allow the county attorney or anybody in this situation to be able to hold people accountable to whatever level of responsibility they have.
Did Representative Lesh.
Representative Kipmar, did the Crow Wing County Attorney, you had mentioned a grand jury. Did the Crow Wing County Attorney call a grand jury to decide whether this case should be charged?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, it was a grand jury that was called on a subject in regards to a person, but as you know, grand jury records are sealed records, and so nobody is able to really know except by virtue of the fact of the county attorney saying that he was unable to get an indictment because of the lack of certainty for the care provider of knowing that this particular person, whoever that may be, that the county attorney worked with, was not eligible to vote.
Okay. And
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How, Representative Kiffmeyer, my question is, you brought up situations, the testifier brought up situations about cases where it was clearly this person was not intelligent enough to vote, not competent to vote, and yet they were allowed to vote. How smart would you say you need to be to vote?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman, in regards to that, it is the court who makes the determinations as to the capacity to vote.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
But you're not satisfied right now with the court's decisions. You want the legislature to do its job and make that decision and make it more clear that all these people are ineligible until the court decides. So clearly you have a different idea than what the courts currently have for how smart you need to be to vote, and I want to know how smart you think you need to be to vote.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, again, it is only the court, and it is only the court that makes that determination because they have all the facts at hand. They have subpoena power. They can have the particular person in front of them. They can have all kinds of information, medical records and other things that none of us are privy to. So I think it is rightfully, it is in the court's hands. And what I'm doing with my bill is that once the court has made that determination that they be clear, and then that the court's decision be clearly communicated amongst all the interested parties that have a responsibility to carrying out the court's determinations in every area of the ward's needs.
Mr. Chair, I believe that Ms. Marshall is here from the courts. I wonder if we could hear from her. Maybe she left. I don't know. About the court's capacity to handle this, if they support this bill, or if they readily have the resources in order to make an additional 23,964 independent decisions before the next election.
Okay, Representative Lesh, is that a question you would like to address to the court's administration?
Chair.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself for the tape and. And have you, I don't know if you heard Representative Lesh's question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. What I understand, Representative Lesh, your question is, does the court have the capacity to go through all of these cases before the next election?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Ms. Marshall and Ms. Chair, as I understand it, there would be another 23,964 people, ballpark, that would need to be noticed, and if they wanted to vote, there'd have to be a court action. Do you have the capacity to handle that before the next election?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't know that we do have the capacity for 23,000 hearings before the next election cycle.
Okay.
And the other thing that complicates it is we will have to do a lot of computer programming. Right now, we send to the Secretary of State notice of those people who are not eligible to vote. Now we will have to send a much larger piece, so it's going to take some computer programming to be able to accomplish that.
Okay.
Representative Lesh?
No, I think that answers my question, Mr. Chair. I just have one other question for Representative Kiffmeyer, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Proceed, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, when I was young, my parents used to do service for our church. We would go pick up men at the local state nursing home, and we'd bring them to church. And these were elderly gentlemen, and several of them had traumatic brain injuries from the war. And there was one named Willie, and Willie had suffered a traumatic brain injury in World War II and had been taken care of by the state since then. And Willie scared me at first. I was 4 years old, and he yelled a lot in church. And I, at first, when my parents brought him, I thought, well, this is kind of what's going on. And after a while, you know, you get used to it. And Willie, when the time came around for the 1980 election, Willie was all gung-ho about Ronald Reagan. He was all about Ronald Reagan because he watched the movies. He thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And for the information of the committee, Mr. Chair, in the weekly reader poll of 1980, I did vote for Ronald Reagan. It was the last time I voted for a Republican, but I voted for Ronald Reagan. And Willie would have, too. And I don't know if Willie voted that year or not. I don't know if he knew enough about Ronald Reagan's policies or Jimmy Carter's policies or John Anderson's policies to make a decision, but he definitely wanted to vote for Ronald Reagan, and I'm not sure that I would be in a position to say he shouldn't be able to, because he really liked Ronald Reagan, even if it was just because he liked the movies. Do you think a decision should have been made for Willie that he wasn't smart enough for Ronald Reagan in that election?
Representative Kiffmeyer, I don't know if we can answer hypothetical questions of that nature here.
Yes, no, Mr. Chairman, I think that is very, very true. But again, I will restate again, Representative Lesh, it is the court, not my opinion. It is the court. And it's not about who you vote for. It is about the court. And it's just simply the capacity and the ability to vote. And it is a court determination, not yours, not mine, not who. But it is about that. And I want to also mention that in this bill also, it says the state court administrator shall provide a notice restating the current voting eligibility status of any ward. In other words, it's restating the current voting eligibility. And a simple spreadsheet can accomplish that. And in any future purposes that the court may have in regards to their computerized list or other things that they may have, that it is a list restating the current voting eligibility status of any ward. And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, but I think that the court on their current records will be able to accomplish that, and I will work with them to have the financial resources for what this particular statute is asking them to do. Would be asking them to do it.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Liebling, I would remind the committee members that we do have a full agenda for today. We do have an extensive list, but we do have a committee room reserved for tonight after session to continue our calendar if need be. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm aware, I'm looking at the audience here, and I know there are a lot of people waiting on other bills, but I think this is a very important bill. I mean, we're talking here about the right to vote, and that's often called by many of us the sacred right to vote. I mean, this is a you know, one of the most important things that, you know, as American citizens, we have the right to vote. We talk about that all the time, how great that is, that people, you know, fight and die for our right to vote. And so unfortunately, the scheduling of this is what it is. But Representative Kiffmeyer, I'm glad I've listened to all of this discussion, because I think I understand where you're going with this, and I think that you've got two pieces here. And one piece is this need to line up definitionally with the Constitution, which I get that. I think that's a laudable thing. I actually kind of disagree with Representative Lesch. I do think that's our job. Our job as legislators is to make sure that what we do is constitutional, and that what we pass, you know, that we that is our job, not only the court's job. It's the court's job if we don't do our job. Okay, so I'm with you on that. But I think you've got two things going on here. One is that definition piece, and the other one is the from what we heard in the beginning about the story about people voting illegally, essentially. I do have a lot of problems with the bill, though. I think the definitional piece you could get to a much simpler, different way, and that is to define, to say that everybody right now who's under guardianship, we're going to now call that a limited guardianship unless, in fact, their right to vote has been taken away. And that would solve the problem, because what you just said about this piece about restating the eligibility, if this bill passes, all of these people who now are eligible to vote will no longer be, and the court will have to tell them, because they will be under a guardianship. And a guardianship is defined by you as not having the right to vote. And I don't know if that's what you intend, but I think that's what this bill does. So if you did it differently and you said everybody currently under guardianship who has not had their right to vote taken away, we will now call that a limited guardianship. And then those who have had their right to vote taken away, we will call that a guardianship. And that would line you up with the constitutional language, I think. You know, not I don't have the constitutional language in front of me, but I think that's what you're really trying to do here. Otherwise, what you will do is take away the right to vote from these 24,000 people who have not had that determined by a court as of right now. Okay, so that's the one piece. I'm with you on it, I think, but I don't think you're doing it right. The second part, which is this issue about people voting who shouldn't be voting or people acting illegally, I don't think, you know, along with my colleagues here, I think this is the wrong way to go about that. I don't think it helps that at all. Because, you know, just because somebody has the legal right to vote doesn't mean that they have the ability to vote in any given election at any given time. And if they don't have the ability to vote, to make the choice to cast their ballot, and somebody's making that choice for them, that is already illegal, and that should be prosecuted. And I frankly don't see why there's any lack of clarity there. I mean, this should have been prosecuted. If somebody is bringing somebody in and marking their ballot without knowing their preference, that is illegal, clearly. And I don't think that anything you're doing here, you know, you don't need anything else to do that. So, you know, as the bill is right now, I think that, as I said, the concern about lining it up with the Constitution, I get that. I think that's fine. But I don't think that's what I don't think you're doing it right. I think you're really, the way the bill is now, I think you're impinging on that sacred right to vote in a way that we absolutely shouldn't be doing. As of today, I am opposed to your bill. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Liebling. My effort to do what you suggested, and thank you for the first part in regards to guardianship and lining things up as we see that as a legislature. But in Section 12, that is my effort at saying, restating the current voting eligibility status of any ward subject to the guardian's supervision. And so that is my effort. And Representative Liebling, I'll chat with you after this bill leaves this committee and see if we can add even some more clarity in line with that, because that would be my intention in that regard, is to not put anybody in that situation. And so prior to the next committee hearing or the next time, I'll work with you to help to help accomplish that.
Okay, next on our list is Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, I didn't follow that. So you're saying that you're not intending to exclude 23,000 people from, or declaring them ineligible to vote. Is that correct?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Allen, no. It is the court that makes that determination. And in Section 12, it's just the court restating what they've already determined in Section 12 via a letter. It's restating what the court has already determined. I don't take away anything.
So
it's not my intention to take away or give anything. It is a matter of clarity, and that if the court, when the court has a determination already made, that they would restate that determination.
Representative Allen.
Mr. Chair, so you're saying that it, the individual would have to now seek an order declaring that they are competent and eligible to vote, the whole class of...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Representative Allen, no, it doesn't require them to do that. Matter of fact, it specifically says that on line 10.15, awards voting eligibility status for purposes of the notice, just this notice, shall be based on the order of the court establishing the guardianship or any subsequent order of the court affecting the ward's right to vote, provided that nothing in this section requires the court to reconsider a previous order or issue a new order related to the ward's right to vote for the sole purpose of providing the notice. However, it is up to the court's discretion at any time or anybody else, but if there already is a court order, one way or the other, the court restates that in this letter.
Representative Allen?
Mr. Chair.
And in most cases, Mr. Chairman, there is a court order in this regard.
Representative Allen?
Mr. Chair. Okay, let's say that, I mean, I agree with Representative Liebling was, you were talking about, you're trying to make this conform with the Constitution, and the Constitution uses the term guardianship. So, I mean, I don't think I think you still need to clarify that, whether you're going, a class of people who are going to now fall in this guardianship are now going to be, their right to vote is going to be taken away. And they're going to have to go to the court to get that right back, where under the current system, the individual with a mental or developmental disability does have the right to vote unless the court specifically took it away in the guardianship order. So you're completely changing the law. And then going back to what Representative Lesch was talking about also is that, do we really want to go back to the intent, the time that the Constitution was enacted and this language was included? I mean, at that, I'm not sure about the exact date, but I would bet that it was at a time when it was also blacks were ineligible to vote, American Indians were ineligible to vote, women were ineligible to vote, and the Constitution is it's outdated. I mean, it uses the term insane. It was at a time when we didn't understand developmental mental disabilities. We thought that blacks and American Indians were not sufficiently either human or competent or smart enough to vote, and so we were, basically wards or enough to vote, and so we were, basically wards or, so there. I mean, there was many of us were under a ward or guardianship, whether legally or just by circumstances, I'm new at this, but I'm just constantly amazed how much legislation, bills. Is brought forward without any sort of legal analysis to whether it would withstand judicial scrutiny. I mean, I would think that we'd be tired of having legislation that's overturned by the courts, and that we would want a better track record. This is something that, because it is a fundamental right, is going to be subject to strict scrutiny. State will have to demonstrate a compelling interest, and it cannot be over-inclusive. And if you have a class that large that's going to be disenfranchised, it's going to be challenged, and you're going to have to the state will have to demonstrate a compelling interest, and I don't think it can in this case, and it really can't, because the measures that are currently in place are sufficient, that there are other measures, laws in place that can address what occurred. And so I guess that's all my comments. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Allen. I want to make clear again, this statute does not take away or give anything in regards to the rights. It is only the court. And is the court restating a previous action or a current action of the court? This is not anything is done in regards to this except via the court. This legislation makes none of those determinations. It is only the court. In regards to the language, I have worked with Mr. McLeod, who is considered in the Bar Association the most knowledgeable person about guardianship law, and this is his, in regards to these definitions, this is his recommendation of language. I also worked with the Disability Law Center, and that is acceptable. This is language that they agreed to also with Mr. McLeod. And so both of them have recommended this language and have agreed to this language, and I think that kind of substantial attorney review is very, very strong. Also, the county attorney supports this. So I think I have met that in regards to this bill, and just again, that the courts, in regards to their determinations, that people with a disability, whether whatever it may be, that the courts do not consider their race, their creed, their color. It is their mental capacity to make these decisions in regards to all aspects of their lives. And it is only the court that makes that determination, none of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer keeps referring to Mr. McLeod, and he is in the audience, and we've actually spoken. And so I really think that it would be appropriate to have him come and chat about that. Did he leave the room? Oh, there he is.
I think he's here.
I just think the testimony should reflect what I, at least what I think it's going to be, is slightly different than what Representative Kiffmeyer represented.
Okay. Welcome to our committee, sir. We're stressed for time here. If we can keep it brief, about 3 minutes maximum.
Okay.
I guess introduce yourself for our tape, please.
Thank you. Robert McLeod, and I just want to be clear that I can only appear here in my individual capacity, and I am not appearing on behalf of the bar, and I have not been able to express any opinions on behalf of the bar. And I want to say that Representative Kiffmeyer has been very, very gracious in working with interested groups, and we have been working with her to provide language to try to make this bill as effective as possible. But I do also want to be clear that I've provided a written objections opposing the bill, and those, I think that's with the Government and Elections Committee.
Prior to this language,
yes. Yes, and so I am not on record as in favor of this bill, and I want to be very, very clear that I am not representing the bar or the bar's position on this bill in any way. So I just want to be very clear on that, but we have been trying to work with Representative Kiffmeyer to work with language to make what she's presenting as useful as possible, although I do have concerns, very, very, very similar concerns to Representative Champion, I believe your name was, sir. In fact, I would just mirror his comments.
Thank you, Mr. McLeod.
Thank you.
Next on our list is Representative Smith. Representative Smith, you have a question for?
No,
okay, all right. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer, is there a term in our statutes already on what limited guardianship means?
Representative Kiffmeyer. Mr. McLeod,
Representative
would you like to
Kiffmeyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I want to be clear. We have been working with Representative Kiffmeyer and trying to provide language to make this bill as clear as possible. And I believe the quick answer to the question is There is a definition of a limited guardian and guardian. A person under guardianship is someone who lacks the right to vote, and a person under limited guardian is someone who retains the right to vote. That is fundamentally the sole distinction.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. Oh. So in current law, it doesn't exist. It's created for this purpose.
Oh, forgive me. Yes,
Mr. McLeod.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, under current law, there is simply a guardian.
Okay.
Under current law, there is simply a guardian, and a guardian is someone appointed for someone who is incapacitated, as opposed to someone who is incompetent. Under old law, pre-1973, or basically older law, someone who is incompetent could not vote. Someone who is incapacitated can vote. And that started in 1973 and was wholly adopted in 2003 as well, where in 2003 we stopped declaring people incompetent, as we no longer found it necessary to declare anyone incompetent. However, if they could not vote, then the court can take the right to vote when it's necessary. But the presumption is to presume all constitutional rights in the person, subject to a burden of proof to show that they do not have the right to vote. A similar question was asked about, well, what is the capacity to vote? As of yet, across the nation, there is no uniform standard. You might find a case or two here and there that talks about various standards, but as of right now, there is no, to my knowledge, uniform standard of the capacity to vote.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
So when I look at Section 12, it simply says that the notice would go out from the court restating the current voting eligibility. It doesn't say that they would then be changed to limited guardianship. If it simply sent out and you were still under guardianship and the court sent out a statement saying, at this time you have the right to vote, it would not be law, because this law would say that under a guardianship you have no right to vote. So unless the court said, sent out by mail, that you have the right to vote and we are now changing you to a limited guardianship, they would not survive this statute. Is that clear? Is that right?
I don't know exactly what, Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know exactly what will happen with that point. The hard part is, under current law, most orders are silent on voting because they presumptively have the right to vote. And so, if upon this law being passed, I don't know what the county administrators will do with that, saying, well, the current law says they're guardianship, so they can't vote, or when that order was passed, they were relying on the statutory presumption, and therefore they have the right to vote. I don't know how counties will start issuing that notice, and that might be a spot worthy of clarity from my point of view, so that there's uniformity throughout the state that if this law goes through, that it's very clear how they will issue the order. What would concern me greatly personally is if they said you don't have the right to vote when presumptively under the statute you did when the order was issued. That would be improper, I believe.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate Mr. McLeod's assistance in going through this and the language, and also any additional clarity that he will work with me on, I will welcome that, and he's been very helpful at this part. So as he knows and as I've worked with him before, we'll take care of that.
One last comment is that we pass things that are basically finished, not basically on the promise that it will be changed. I find this very unclear, so that a person from the time that this passes until the time they actually go to the voting poll, it may not be clarified. What I see in Section 12 does not answer it for me, just as he said, that it's unclear, because very clearly it says, if you're under guardianship, you're not eligible, period. A piece of paper that says, I have the right to vote, will not stand. I find this very unclear and very disturbing.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. McLeod, for your testimony prior to you coming up. I understood from Representative Kiffmeyer you were a supporter of the bill, so it helped to have some clarification on that point, interestingly enough. I would like to ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair, and that's about it for me. Thanks.
Okay, roll call has been noted.
And, Mr. Chairman, I just want to be clear that I mentioned that Mr. McLeod was helpful on the language and the language of the definition of guardianships. And I did not say that he was supportive of the bill in that way, shape, or form, and did not intend to communicate that. I just stated a material fact of us being helpful on the language and stated my thanks to that.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. On the issue of the fiscal note, the chair notes that the Ways and Means Committee has authorized, I shouldn't say use that term, excuse me, that we do have the capability of sending the bill to them, and they will be looking for the fiscal note before final passage of this bill. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So will we be doing that with other bills? I mean, is this precedent setting, and can we have DFL bills get sent to the Ways and Means Committee without fiscal notes in the future as well, Mr. Chair?
This was, this is the deadline week, and this was at the, pardon me. Okay, yes. As we get to deadlines, we'll take that into consideration.
Mr. Chair, I just think that fiscal notes is the job of this committee, and analysis is the job of this committee, and that these bills should not be passed out without fiscal notes and without fixing the bills before they leave here.
Representative Lesh.
Just by way of, it's been elucidated and already established in this committee that if we fail to fix a bill, you know, we can always rely on the courts to fix it later if we screw up.
All right. A roll call having been requested on the bill. Or first of all, I believe we've gone through all the testimony that, but if there is anyone else that needed to testify in this bill, here, seeing none, we will move to the roll call vote. Okay. Representative Vogel, will you renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to adopt House File 2188 as amended and sent to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Szymanski.
Yes.
Representative Mazerall.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Allen.
No.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Cornish.
Yes.
Representative Grunhagen.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Kreisel. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lesh.
No.
Representative Liebling.
No.
Representative Schumacher.
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Swazinski.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative Wardlow.
Yes.
The results of the roll call is 10 ayes, 7 nays. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Okay, the next bill on our agenda today is our House File 2762 with Representative Westrom. Would someone like to move the bill to bring it before our committee today? Representative Anderson, would you like to move House File 2762?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 2762 to the General Register.
Okay. Motion is to move House File 2762, recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. Welcome, Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the bill in front of you deals with structured settlements and an issue that the courts have brought to our attention, and I've got Ms. Marshall here to explain in greater detail the concern that's been experienced or observed in the courts, and basically having the district courts communicate and avoid the option or the potential of forum shopping or venue shopping with somebody trying to sell a structured settlement to a company that a structured settlement is entered into in many cases in a settlement of a larger case with payments over a period or structured a number of years. There's companies that like to buy those structured settlements, which in many cases they'll buy them for, you know, a fraction or a percentage of the amount of them and then pay cash to the person, and then they will receive the payments into the future. This would simply just have the courts be communicating so one court isn't played against another. If one court denies it, and the next court should know and be aware that that was it was tried in another court. As I've discussed this issue with the courts, and I'll let Ms. Marshall go into greater detail.
Sorry. Good morning, Ms. Marshall. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Janet Marshall, and I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. The bill before you, sections 1, 2, and 3, were part of a bill last year and were actually passed by the House last year. So I will just briefly. Section 1 is errors and omissions, and it requires that a petitioner who seeks to correct a ballot error has to serve a copy of the petition on all candidates for the office. This came to us because when this occurs, the court then has to stay the proceedings and serve the candidates for the office because they think it's important that they know what's going on, and that these cases are very time sensitive, and we just think that it would be easier if they had to serve them up front. The second one is the predatory registration form. Under current practice, it is primarily probation who helps the offender fill out the predatory offender form. The statute says the court is supposed to do this, and we were just requested to clarify the law to reflect current practice. The third one is housing court referees. In Hennepin and Ramsey counties, they use housing court referees. This proposal would mirror what is currently happening in family court in those two counties, and that is when you have your case, you can go to a referee or you can go to a judge. You get a choice. Instead of what is happening now is you go to a referee, and if you don't like the referee's decision, then you get to go to a judge and have a whole new trial. So this would just give you a choice, one or the other. And it does not take away the requirement that the judge has to review all of the referee's findings. That is still intact. Number four is the new section, and as Representative Westrom said, this has to do with structured settlements. This proposal would require an applicant to inform the court if there have been earlier applications for transfers of their structured settlement. This change will help judges make much more informed decisions on structured settlements. And this came to us from Hennepin County and an unfortunate case there where the person, it was a victim of childhood lead poisoning. She had a personal injury settlement and she started selling off pieces of it, and she was going from county to county so that the courts had no information that she actually was going around trying to shop to sell her settlement. She came to Hennepin County, and the judge got suspicious and appointed the guardian because she was actually a vulnerable adult and was doing this. So the judges think that if they know of other attempts, they will be able to make a much more informed decision, because otherwise they have nothing to go on and really no reason not to say okay to these things. So that's what that piece is.
Very. Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Any questions for this testifier? Questions on this bill? Hearing none. Representative Anderson renews her motion that House File 2762 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. The motion before us, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Westrom. Next on our calendar is, we're going to skip down on our calendar a little bit to House File 2220 with Representative Poppy. And Representative Poppy, we are in on short time here. If your testifiers can come to the table with you. Would someone like to move House File 2220 to bring it before the committee? Okay, Representative Hillstrom moves House File 2220 be recommended to pass. Our anticipation is we may lay it over, depending if we may not have time to complete testimony today. We'll very likely go to public safety. Yes. Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry
Chair.
For the delay.
Members.
Please proceed.
We do appreciate the accommodation. We do have people from Mower County. This bill, House File 2220, came about because of a horrific situation in Mower County involving parents and two young children. This case received significant media attention and coffee shop chatter. The consequences to these parents for using extreme and radical child restraint was limited by the current statute. Thus, the Sheriff's Department, Social Services, the county attorney, and the public who witnessed or were made aware of the case seek a higher level of consequence in these extreme cases. The House Research Bill summary accurately reflects the bill, so we'd like to use our time describing the reason for the bill. I do have the Mower County Sheriff, as well as the county attorney, a social worker, and a sheriff's detective here, and I think we're going to start out with the sheriff's detective and social worker describing what exactly happened so that you can understand the purpose for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Please move to the microphone and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Detective Steve Sandvik with the Mower County Sheriff's Office. The reason we're here today is one word, the difference between demonstrable and substantial. The easiest way for me to explain this is to say a five-year-old child was bound by this chain daily from the time he came home from school till the time he went back to school. That is a gross misdemeanor. That's all we could charge. It was the most horrible thing Gail Loverink and I ever witnessed. To keep it short and brief, a gross misdemeanor. We are not allowed to treat first-degree murderers that way, and yet less than a year in jail.
Okay. All right. Is that the extent of your testimony?
At this point.
Okay.
Sure.
All right.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Nelson. I am the Mower County Attorney. And we are here with this bill because we did have a lot of public outcry. My office thought long and hard about charging in this matter. And the exact situation that we had is exactly what the statute was as written. They were gross misdemeanors because we didn't have substantial bodily harm. We had demonstrable bodily harm. We had bruising. We had some swelling. And quite frankly, there was a rust stain on this child's ankle. Because of the time that this chain was spent to that child. We are asking for the change from substantial to demonstrable. Demonstrable harm is the harm that is used in the assault on a peace officer statute. It is used other places in statute. It is defined in the jury instructions as any harm that can be observed by another person. So that's the standard we're asking for. We don't think, looking at it, that it's that we're asking for too much to ask that somebody that chains, cages, or ties their child in a cruel manner for a prolonged period of time should get a gross misdemeanor. We think that's felonious conduct. In this case, it was clearly felonious conduct that we simply couldn't charge. And we think that kids who are chained like this deserve better.
Thank you. And welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself.
I am Therese Amazai, the Mower County Sheriff, and I have 28 years of law enforcement experience, and I can say without a doubt that we have never had a case similar to this case, nor do we ever hope to ever have one again. But we ask for your assistance in, as the county attorney stated, in making this a felony as opposed to a gross misdemeanor. We don't see many of these cases, thankfully, and hopefully we never see another. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions among the committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Representative Poppy, for presenting your bill today. This bill will be laid over. Representative Representative Smith, would you like to present your bill yet? Or Representative Johnson, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, could we just move that one to public safety? Would that be satisfactory?
Representative Cornish?
I'll do whatever.
2220, would you like to?
I'll leave it up to you. I'm not requesting it, but.
You're not requesting it?
Yeah,
that's fine. Representative Johnson, would you like to send it to public safety?
Yeah, I'll make the motion to move the public safety.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
I guess the committee administrator requested it, so yeah.
Okay.
That's fine.
Representative Hillstrom.
That was all, Mr. Chair. I was just going to clarify if public safety didn't want it, where was the end result going to be? But if Representative Cornish wants it, I think that's an appropriate motion.
All right. Okay. The motion before us then is to. That House File 2220 be recommended to pass and sent to the Public Safety Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The bill is passed. Okay. Representative Johnson, would you like to proceed with your bill today or would you like to postpone it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My testifiers were here, but I don't see them. Looks like. I wouldn't mind going real quick.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think he stepped out for a second just to see if the testifiers are here.
Okay. Have we got the high sign? Oh. Representative Johnson, would you like to introduce your bill? Representative Johnson, you have the microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2000 be passed and go to the General Register.
Okay, the motion before us is how Representative Johnson moves House File 2000, recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Briefly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the purpose of this bill is to address the need for courthouse security and begin a discussion on how to best pay for it. And what the bill says is that a county board may, and that's the operative word, may, establish a court security fee not to exceed $15 in district court and for civil and criminal matters. Now, 13 other states do this and with fees ranging from $5 to $30. This fee is paid to the county treasurer or auditor for a variety of security purposes, such as x-ray machines, metal detectors, ID card systems, as well as training expenses. Now, courthouse security is the responsibility of sheriffs, as you probably know, and here to testify are Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek to my left and Jim Franklin, Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. We also have Carver County Commissioner and AMC President Randy Maluchinik here. Oh, there he is, to say a few words. Although I'm not necessarily totally sold on assessing the fees and see the responsibility of this court security as largely a state responsibility, people are going in and out of courts these days, and those working in the courts and those people using the courts deserve to know that their safety is protected, and that's why we have the bill here. We need consistent courthouse security. Courthouse security throughout the state. With that, I'll turn over to Hennepin County Sheriff Stanek.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I would note that we have exceeded our committee time, but we will take the testimony this morning. Welcome, Sheriff Stanek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for allowing me to come before you. My name is Rich Stanek, Sheriff in Hennepin County. I know time is short, so I'll make my comments very brief. Now, I want to thank Representative Johnson for bringing this bill forward. It not only draws attention to the very important issue of courtroom security, but he had reached out to me a couple weeks ago knowing how important this issue is to the residents of Hennepin County as well, and it's being debated really across the state in all of our counties. And although I'm not here to endorse this particular court fee, I am here to encourage a discussion on how we're going to provide greater courtroom security in our counties across Minnesota. You know, Mr. Chair, members, as you know, our court system is run by the state, but the courtrooms in which the judges preside are run by the county. And county sheriffs have mandated to provide bailiffs and courtroom security. In Hennepin County alone, we have 8 different courthouse facilities with 96 courtrooms in all. And of these 8 courthouses, 4 of them currently have weapon screening capabilities. Mr. Chair, members, with this weapon screening in place, we've confiscated over 3,400 different weapons from people who are attempting to enter our courtrooms during the last 6 months of 2011. Those weapons range from the small pocket knives to handguns. Now, each of Minnesota's 87 counties have a different story to tell and would have different courtroom security needs. In other words, Mr. Chair and members, one size does not fit all. And I'm not here to create fear or alarm, but given the events of recent history both here in Minnesota as well as across the nation, the time is now for state and county officials to come together on this. These court cases that we're hearing range from highly charged emotional events to termination of parental rights all the way down to traffic tickets, murder, domestic assault, etc. In between. The AMC and Minnesota Sheriff's Association and others currently have a working group that I think Executive Director Franklin will talk about, but you know, perhaps the legislature might consider working with them on this issue. Again, I appreciate Sheldon's bringing this forward and having a candid discussion about it, a very timely issue. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm available for questions either here or later, depending on your committee's needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Stanek. Next testifier, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Randy Malichnik. I'm the current president of Association of Minnesota Counties and a county commissioner for Carver County. I'd like to thank the committee and you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify, and thank Representative Johnson for authoring House File 2000. AMC supports the authority of county boards to implement fees as an alternate source of revenue for dedicated purposes. The bill authorizes such a fee at the county board's discretion for the implementation of additional court security needs as determined by local criminal justice partners, with the emphasis on collaboration and partners, the county board, the sheriff, the local bench, and others. The Carver County Board of Commissioners passed a resolution supporting implementation of adding a court security fee on criminal and civil cases like the one mentioned in House File 2000. While Carver County is the smallest of the seven metro counties, it is one of the fastest growing counties in the state. The county has an interesting mix of urban and rural and offers a good example of the growing security threat that is evident across the state, given the unfortunate headlines in the counties as diverse as Hennepin and Cook. So Carver looks at the security question as when, not if, problem, and we're interested in mitigating the risks related to as a when problem. From a practical standpoint, Carver has funded and implemented a variety of security improvements over the past several years, but there are a number of significant changes that are still needed. Among them is the lack of a metal detector. Carver County is one of the few metro counties without weapons screening. Cost to implement weapon screening in the county is a significant one-time cost, estimated at $150,000, with ongoing operating costs of $250,000 per year. If there were a $15 court security fee, it is estimated that the county would generate $123,000 annually. And there are many other security concerns to address beyond metal detection, such as security cameras, exterior lighting upgrades, reception desk modification, and appropriate training. So even with the security fee, there would be a significant burden on the county's main revenue source, the property tax, which has been continually pressured by difficult economic times that we have faced that all of you are aware of. So the County Board of Commissioners looks at security fee as a fair way to raise additional revenue needed to address the concern. The bottom line is that the County Board as a whole and commissioners individually, like myself, bear the ultimate responsibility for securing our court facilities. The need for additional security measures is going to vary widely across the state, and the assessment and plan of the action to meet that need is done best locally. We would very much like our county and all Minnesota's counties to have this additional tool in our toolbox as we determine that the court security need in our county and how we will fund the cost of addressing that need. And I'll be glad to stand for any questions. I brought along with me, there has been a particular contentious case in Carver County. There was a blog started with a great many references to the judge and threatening his quality of life or existence, and I'd be glad to share that with any members of the committee who would like to see that, but I think you all probably believe that the threat is true and is out there. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll be glad to stand questions now or later time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Malichnik. We are very, very over time already. Mr. Franklin, if you would just like to give us a couple minutes of your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. I'll be very, very brief. We recognized this threat several years ago. The Sheriff's Association has developed a training program. We actually implemented the training program about a year ago. before this shooting. Unfortunately, the shooting in Cook County has catapulted us to the forefront of this training program. It's a very excellent training program where we focus on a number of what we term recognition of highly emotionally charged events, how to de-escalate those, how to recognize them, how to coordinate them. I want to just highlight, this is not just the sheriff's responsibility. This is all of our responsibilities, and we teach and have public defenders, prosecutors, court, sheriff's personnel, law enforcement officers attending. It's all of our business to try to keep the court safe. We have done an assessment. I won't go into those details. And we have a working group. In fact, in the next 30 minutes, I'm to meet with the chief judge and her group of advisors. The courts have been very responsive. The AMC has been very responsive. We have a group working together trying to better address this program. Out of our survey, what we found is we have issues. Sheriff Stanek has pointed out we have great variants of our courthouses and our capabilities and our equipment throughout the state, but we're not as bad as what people might make us out to be. We do have capabilities that do exist. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin, for your comments, and gentlemen, for your concerns for the safety of the staff and visitors to our courthouses. We have exceeded our committee time. Representative Johnson, we will table this bill for further discussion. I would like to remind the committee members that apologize for the late notice, but we have talked to House and Senate leadership. The bills on our agenda technically have met deadline, and they will be continued next week. We will not be meeting tonight for that reason. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I have one question for the gentleman from Carver County.
Okay. We have the next committee that's ready to move into this room.
I understand, but I bet she's not going to be here next time, Mr. Chair. Okay. And I'm wondering if so you'll be here for the next. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Liebling is next.
Okay. I wanted to thank Representative Johnson for bringing this. This is an incredibly important topic, which we have barely addressed this session, even though, you know, we're doing a lot with guns, and we haven't talked about courtroom safety. I also have a bill for courtroom safety with a different funding source, which I will not go into right now, but I'm just really glad we have this here, and I'm really sorry that there's so little time, because it really deserves a lot more discussion. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It made deadline because this is a finance committee, and we're going to deal with the finance issues.
Great.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.